We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Before we introduce our returning champion guest, I would like to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. And as you guys may have heard before, I have a list of my favorite Chessable courses. And guess what? There's a new favorite, starting out with 1d4 by a certain Grandmaster Ben Feingold, as we will be discussing among many other topics. But you can also see my favorites related for different rating levels, different subjects, little capsules guiding you. So check that out and check out all their other new material. I legitimately can't keep up. Grandmaster Jon Ludvig Hammer has a new course on the Nimzo. And there's tons of other fun stuff coming. We've got some more guests in the pipeline as well. But without further ado, let's introduce you to our five-time guest, two-time U.S. Open co-champ, two-time National Open co-champ, 2002 World Open co-champion. He's a Twitch star, a YouTube star, a husband of the rising poker star Karen Boyd, and now a Chessable author. Welcome back, Grandmaster Ben Feingold.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be here again. I'm glad I'm your five-time guest.
Yeah, what an honor of all your accomplishments. But
that might be the greatest one. Yeah.
I think it's the Chessable course, which we'll get to momentarily. And for listeners, Ben and I might be a little weary. We actually tried to stream this on his Twitch channel, but after 45 minutes of tech problems, we had to resign. So we resigned. We're not live streaming it. But of course, this is available on all your platforms, and we're going to dive right in. So, Ben, I'm going to start you out with a hard-hitting question this time from a friend of the podcast, the Ono's Own Patreon supporter as well. So he asks, if you ever regret dedicating your life to chess or think about the opportunity cost of doing so. And on a similar note, he wonders, what do you think about adult improvers dedicating big chunks of their own free time to a game they will at best be semi-decent? And what does he think? What do you think is wrong with such people, if anything?
Well, the first question, no, I don't regret, because you know it's life, and you choose the way you live your life, and you can always make a lot of different choices. But there's no reason to regret the choices you made, because that's basically who you are. And I was born in a chess family, as my dogs will agree with, and I mean, that's what I do, is I do chess stuff. So I don't regret that at all. And I've done different chess stuff, because I've played chess, I've taught chess, I've done commentary in St. Louis, I do commentary from Twitch, streaming now, Chessable. I mean, chess really hit a big boon, the last three or four years. So I can't complain that I'm in the chess business. Now, your second question, I have sort of the same answer. If adult learners want to spend a lot of time on chess, then they're doing what they want to do. And some will see a lot of progress, some won't see as much, and that's life. So you sort of want to do what you want to do. And if you're not progressing, you can always do something else or keep at it. And I mean, that's the way life is. And you can, if you regret what you're doing, you can always do something else.
Yeah, it's a tricky question. I mean, I think it's certainly normal to have some doubts if you're spending a lot of time on the game, but I feel like there's beauty in finding something that captivates you. You know, like a lot of people don't have that. So when you find it, I do think it can be worth pursuing. But Ben, I want to follow up because obviously, as we've talked about in prior interviews, you're pretty successful these days. You've built quite a following. But were there periods younger in your life when you were still finding your footing? Did you ever have any regrets about putting so much into chess at those points?
Yeah, I mean, for most of my chess quote unquote career, I was, poor, and chess tournaments didn't pay a lot. Lessons didn't pay a lot. And, you know, I liked playing chess and I liked traveling to different tournaments, different countries. So, you know, I think doing what you love is more important than money. And hopefully doing what you love will pay you a lot of money at some point. So I don't have any regrets in that vein, but I mean, probably at least half of my chess career was trying to figure out like how to pay the rent and how to afford my next meal. Cause that's the nature of chess from, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now that there's, the internet and streaming and giving lessons online and other Chessable, chess.com, other ways to make money. It's a lot easier now for somebody like me. But yeah, I mean, before that, when it was just go to a weekend tournament and you need to win your last round to be able to eat the next day, those were difficult times, but that's the decision I made. And I think I'm a lot happier with that than a lot of other people I know who quit chess and decided to make money and not really doing something that's engaging to them that they really enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, at this point you've got the best of both worlds. So are you in touch with a lot of, I mean, I know like in prior interviews, your friend, I Am Stuart Rachels has come up. And obviously he's, successful professor, but, are you in touch with a lot of, former chess players who are checking in on the chess world?
I keep in touch with Patrick Wolf and Stuart, as you said. Patrick's actually playing in the senior championship, which is this month, I think, in St. Louis. So he's actually playing chess, which is he plays in the senior championship when he can. That's about the only tournament he plays in.
I think I saw he was playing an event in California. I mean, he lives in California, but in the Bay Area recently as well. So maybe he's dipping his toe in a little bit more, or maybe he just wanted to warm up for the seniors.
Yeah, probably warm up. And what's funny is occasionally on chess.com when I'm playing Blitz, I get paired with Adam Leaf, who's a colleague of mine from the U.S. Junior Championships, who like doesn't play chess anymore, but he plays on chess.com.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people do that quote unquote quit chess. They'll play some Blitz online and they follow chess. They just aren't playing professionally because, life got in the way.
Yeah. But
I was one of the few people from my generation of kids playing in the juniors every year that actually went on to just do chess full time. And I wasn't the strongest. I mean, Patrick Wolf and Fishbein and Stuart Rachels were always better than me. But Fishbein somehow mixed the two. He plays chess all the time and he works all the time.
Yeah.
So somehow, I mean, obviously he's not as good as he used to be because he's not probably studying chess very much. He plays for fun. But he never really quit chess. He just got a job, raised a family, and somehow played chess all the time also.
Yeah, also kind of the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Ben, so you mentioned Patrick playing in the seniors. I know you're retired, although I also saw you played in a tournament in March, and I apologize if you explained this on stream, but what's the story behind the local tournament you played in March?
That was a Blitz tournament.
Oh,
it wasn't
okay.
Flow Chess. Yeah, oh. And just because me and Archer and Karen went up to our old chess club, that was our chess club, and it was we sold it, and we hadn't played there, and I figured since Karen and Archer were playing, I would just join them.
Okay, I missed that it was a Blitz tournament. Now, my real question was, being that you turned 54, I believe in October.
September.
Do you get tempted to play in senior events, even while being semi-retired like Patrick does?
No. I don't want to play any slow chess ever.
Wow.
Then people will see my games. That can't be good.
Even avoiding the kids.
Yeah, I avoid everybody. But even in the Blitz tournament, where everybody was 1,000 points less than me, all the games were super tough. I mean,
but you're still 2,700 on chess.com. I mean, obviously, I know you feel like you should play better, but, you know, that's pretty good.
It's okay, but, yeah, when I see the strength of my moves and positions, then the rating doesn't affect me as much as how badly I play now.
Okay, so you're holding strong. Like when I interviewed Karen last year, we were saying, you know, maybe he'll get the bug at some point, and especially to the extent, I know we'll get to Karen's poker later, but to the extent that you're traveling with her to tournaments anyway, we thought, oh, sooner or later, maybe he'll get bored. But right now, you're saying that's not on the horizon?
No, that's not going to happen.
Man, bummer. Well, as long as you guys still make it to tournaments, and eventually I make it to one. Well, you're going to the National Open, correct?
Right. I'm working at the National Open. I'm doing a chess camp and a simul and some game analysis. My usual stuff at the National Open. It's a fun tournament. They're actually breaking records this year, attendance records. So they have a lot of tournaments there. It's a chess festival. They have a women's tournament, which already has 60 players, which is a record for them. And the National Open itself is going to have over 1,100 players, which is
amazing.
Also, I think, going to be a record. So people are coming back into chess. Obviously, Vegas is a great location for a chess tournament, and it's National Open is becoming what it once was before the pandemic, when, you know, tournaments weren't well attended, but now they seem to be, people are starving for chess.
Yeah. And that's June 14th to 18th. So we'll be 2 days after we record this. So if anyone, I mean, after this releases, so if anyone hears this and wants to hightail it to Vegas and meet Ben, then by all means, they should go for it. So we have another listener question, another question from a Patreon supporter of the pod. And this one is from Roy Lopes, not Roy Lopez, but Roy Lopes. And Roy, thanks for supporting the pod, Roy. He asks, so some of this you've discussed on stream and in prior interviews, but it's always good to expound upon. He asks, according to your experiences, what are the best advice you gave to improving adult chess players besides never move the F-pawn?
Well, it's just never play F3 or F6. F4 and F5 are fine. The best advice I gave? Well, I think the best advice for any adult improver is to not get bogged down with your rating and how much it's going up or not going up, and enjoying the process of playing chess again, and, you know, enjoying it. And enjoying the journey of studying chess and playing and trying to improve, instead of worrying about what successes you've had from what you're doing. Otherwise, people can get perturbed and have one bad tournament and decide it wasn't worth it, when the journey itself is what makes it worth it, studying and playing and trying to improve yourself and doing something different and coming back into chess. Because a lot of people I know that are adult, you know, learners and improvers were playing chess as a kid. Sometime in high school or college, they stopped. They got jobs and families, careers, and now they love chess again and they want to get better. And it's good to persevere and not, you know, think about what your result is all the time, but the enjoyment you get from studying and playing and being part of the chess community. And I think with the adult learners, you know, the chess punks, there's a big chess community there online, and they're all rooting for each other. and it makes you feel like you're part of some kind of family. So it's really nice for that reason. And hopefully people won't get discouraged and quit if they're not getting big successes right away. Because unlike when we were kids, kids are good now. So it's tough to play kids now. But that doesn't mean we can't still beat them sometimes.
Yeah, it's a big difference. And what do you think, Ben, like when you get frustrated because you're losing more games, you know, one might argue, at least I feel this way, I don't feel like I'm a worse player, but maybe I'm worse than my peak, but I feel like I'm basically where an average of where I was in, say, the 20 years since my peak, but my rating is at its low, basically. And I know that that's fairly common. Do you think that there's some that one should adjust? Like, should these federations like FIDE and US Chess think about adjusting the rating parameters, or should we just deal with the fact that it's a moving target and that people as a whole are getting better at chess?
Yeah, people are better at chess now because of all the opportunities with online stuff and traveling and so forth and coaching. It's a lot easier to get coaching and good coaching. It's a lot cheaper, you know, with Chessable and Grandmaster coaches everywhere being available. And you know, it's easy to study chess online. So the people are better at chess now than they were, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. They play better moves. They understand more and they have more practice, you know, because of sites like, you know, chess.com. You can play chess 24 hours a day. I don't recommend, but some people do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, obviously it's a different world and we have to adjust to that. And, you know, we have to play our own game and work as hard as we can. Although I'm retired, so I don't have to do that. But yeah, if I ever wanted to get back into playing shape, it would take so much work from something from me, which I don't really want to do because I would never be as good as I used to be. And so you have to have the love of the game and the will to play. And I didn't, unlike a lot of adult learners and chess improvers, I didn't like take 25 years off and then say, okay, I'm coming back because I love chess. I've always loved chess and I've always played. So I played in my teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s. I was playing chess all the time. So it's not like I've missed out and I wasn't playing chess and now I'm hungering for playing chess again. I've always played chess. And I've always followed chess. And even in retirement, I'm playing on my stream. I'm playing dozens and dozens of games a week on the internet, on chess.com. So I'm still, you know, chess still surrounds my life. It's just playing in classical tournaments isn't something that I'm looking to do. And I think the person who would agree with me the most is Greg Shahadi.
Yeah, he was an early adopter.
He doesn't like classical chess.
Yeah, an early adopter and hating classical chess and wanting it to be moved online. And just to read the rest of Roy's comment, he mentioned he's a big fan of your YouTube series on game reviews. They're always super instructive and entertaining. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I especially love your looks at players from the past. But Ben, I wanted to tell you, because hearing you discuss this, I'm thinking I reviewed our prior interviews and you've given some good advice in this regard before, where you said, for example, and I'm sure you say this on stream all the time, the two main things are to play tougher competition and to review the games extensively. Mm-hmm. But so I'm working on a book, which is sort of like the collected wisdom of chess improvement wisdom, but I also tell some stories in it. And one of the stories I tell, Ben, I stole one of your best stories. At least I think it's one of your best stories. You did in our prior interview call it your crowning chess achievement, where you got to watch Kasparov and Karpov do a postmortem.
I like
Tilburg. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I stole that story, and in that interview, you mentioned that you wrote about it for Chess Life. So I'm like, oh, let me go look at the Chess Life archives, since US Chess graciously puts the whole archives. Mm-hmm. And so I found your write up. There was nothing too illuminating in that write up, but what struck me is in those 4 years where you were in Europe, you were writing and going to all these tournaments. You were like traveling and covering these events all the time. So
yeah, I did stuff for Chess Life, and I also wrote for a Danish magazine, Skakbladet. And they just translated it into Danish what I wrote. So they were asking me to do chess stuff also.
Okay.
So I was writing for more than one publication at that time. Yeah.
And it was typically the same events. Like you would cover one event for US Chess and concurrently be covering it for the Danish magazine.
No, it was different because some of the US was like, you know, US Championship or, you know, US Open or some American tournament and big tournaments in Europe. And occasionally they would be the same tournament that would happen.
And then you get paid twice.
That's right. I get two paychecks this way. Okay. Good Simpsons reference.
And the Kasparov-Karpov reference, and again, listeners can go back and listen. I believe it was our second interview. Were you just there as a reporter or were you playing? And I know you weren't in the elite section.
No, I just went there to watch the tournament. And one of the Tilburg tournaments, I don't think it was that one. My mom came with me and she was just visiting because Spencer was just born. He was a baby. And she was visiting. And I remember when we got there, I was pointing out some of the players to her. And I said, that's Anand. And she said, is he a grandmaster? So I was like, yes, they're all grandmasters. that was very impressive at that time. But yeah, I would go to Tilburg. You know, it was like 2.5 hours by train from where I lived. So I would just go and watch the tournament for a day and then come back. Just so I could just watch the tournament. Wasn't necessarily to report on it, although in that instance, I think I was reporting on it.
Okay. And what's your favorite tournament that you attended, like whether you played or just attended in that era?
Wow, favorite tournament. I like the tournaments a lot in the Netherlands. And I played in Vijfontein, and at that time I played in the B group. At that time, there was only the A and the B group. And now the B group is like 2,700 players. But back then, the B group was, you know, like 2,400 to 2,600, right in my wheelhouse. And that was really well organized, and the players were treated really well. I like playing in Groningen, which is also in the Netherlands. And one of my best tournaments ever was the ORA tournament in Amsterdam. And that was a really strong tournament. I think I was like the second lowest rated player in the tournament. And there were like 26 players. So those are my favorite tournaments, were probably in the Netherlands. They were really well organized. And I like being in the Netherlands.
We will be right back with more stories from Grandmaster Ben Feingold. And we are back. Okay. And Ben, in our 2021 interview, I had asked you about Mikhail Tal, and you mentioned the World Chess Festival 1988, getting to see him play against Zapata. And you also said that particular tournament we could do a whole podcast about. So what else comes? We're not going to do a whole podcast, but what else comes to mind when you think of that tournament?
Well, that was great because that was a festival. They had two international tournaments where just lots of GMs played, like basically two New York Opens. Want to like make a comparison? They had the candidates matches. All the best players in the world were there. And they had the World Blitz Championship, which was a knockout, and they had qualifying events. I almost qualified. And if I would have qualified, I would have been paired with Kasparov in the first round.
Wow.
So I would have got knocked out. But that was amazing because all the best chess players in the world were there. And Tal won the World Blitz Championship. And Tal won $50,000, which, I mean, now is chicken feed, but in 1988, $50,000 is the equivalent of $2 billion now. So, I mean, $50,000 in a Blitz tournament was unheard of in 1988. And so that's all the best players in the world played. And my favorite first round pairing and favorite pairing of the whole tournament was round one, Shirazi Karpov. Talk about two different styles of players. And yeah, Karpov, you know, tore him limb from limb. But that was a great event. The candidates matches were great. The World Blitz Championship was great. The internationals were great. It lasted for a month. And we were there the whole time. We rented a house. And we just, we played in all the tournaments we could. I was there with Fred Lindsay and Ray Stone, if you know those gentlemen. And yeah, I mean, it was really, really, really cold. I you can't even understand how cold it was. You've never been in such snowstorms, ice, 30 below zero. because it was February in New Brunswick.
Right.
So that's the truth hurts. But when you were inside, then it was great. And one story I remember, which is not funny, but I like it. I was a vegetarian at that time. Now I'm a vegan. And John Spielman's always been a vegetarian. Maybe he's a vegan now. I don't know, but probably just a vegetarian. And he ordered some food that was some kind of vegetarian calzone. And I was sitting at the table with him. And he said, "This is great. You should try some." And he almost gave me all of his calzone. And I said, "Well, this is your calzone. Like, you shouldn't give me like 90% of it. You should, you know, it is good. I agree." Right. But he's a very generous person. He wanted to hook up another fellow vegetarian. But there's so many stories from that event because there's so many super strong grandmasters. And Fred Lindsay asked Valery Salov at that tournament, "Are there any strong Russian players we haven't heard of who are going to be really strong in the future?" And remember, this was 1988. And he said, "Vasily Ivanchuk." Okay. And neither one of us had heard of Ivanchuk. Me and Fred never heard of him. He was an IM. And a month after that tournament, he played the New York Open and he won clear first as an IM. So Salov was right. And then the rest is history.
Were you in New York for that tournament? Or?
That's a good question. No, I wasn't. I wasn't okay. In New York. Although funnily, Ray Stone was the other guy who was staying with us. And he played Ivanchuk in the first round.
Oh, wow.
So that's sort of funny too, that he says Ivanchuk and then Ray plays him and then he wins the tournament. Then he becomes like one of the greatest superstars ever. So that's, I mean, Salov was right. He knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I remember I read Dirk Jantan Guzendam's book, Linares, Linares, which is like a fun sort of, you know, year by year retrospective of that tournament, which gives you a little slice of sort of like the rising stars. And I know that Ivanchuk,
one of the greatest games ever is Ivanchuk tearing apart Kasparov in that Sicilian.
Right.
That's,
yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the greatest games ever.
Yeah.
I mean, Kasparov with his queen on h8 and all his pieces couldn't move. And I was like, man, Ivanchuk must be good.
Yeah. Yeah. And so have you met him in person, Ivanchuk?
I've never spoken to Ivanchuk, but I've seen him at a few tournaments.
Okay.
But we've never chatted.
And obviously you're a busy guy with your streaming. We'll get into your summer plans later, but like, does reminiscing about going to events and seeing top players, like, would it feel the same to you if you were, how would you feel if you were just a spectator at Norway Chess, which is ongoing as we record?
Oh yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Like
when I went to Tilburg, I wanted to see the tournament. Yeah.
Right. But I feel like, I don't know. I feel like some of the luster maybe has been lost. Like when I interviewed, when I talked about YK and Z, you know, they talk about how all the players used to be in the hotel bar, but now it's like more professionalized. Do you feel that some of the element of just seeing people everywhere and them not having handlers and them not preparing all the time, like, do you think it would feel the same?
No, it's better when you can see the players and hang out with them, of course. I don't know how much different it is now than before. However, that reminded me of a good story. In 1979, my family drove to Montreal to watch the Montreal tournament. And we got autographs from some of the players. That was one of the first big super tournaments. And my dad, I was 9 years old. My dad said, "Let's go to this hotel. It's the best hotel in Montreal, and walk around and see if we see any players." Didn't know they were staying there. He just said, "This is the best hotel."
Okay.
So we went there and we walked around like in the lobby and like where shops were. And we saw Robert Huebner, and my dad talked to him for like 15 minutes.
Nice.
He was glad to talk to somebody about chess. And I was like, man, I wouldn't even have thought of that. Like, I don't know where the players are staying. Let's guess this hotel and see if we could find one of them. And he did. So that's amazing. You know. But yeah, it was cool. It's cool. Like in St. Louis, obviously, when they have these big events like U.S. Championship and Sinkfield Cup, U.S. Women's Championship, U.S. Junior, Senior, sometimes you can just hang out with the players in the chess club. And one time when Archer was about 5 or 6 years old, Fabi said, "Let's play some Bug House." And we have video of Archer and Fabi playing Bug House just in the chess club because they're just hanging around. And that's, you know, you don't get those kind of experiences unless you go to tournaments and the players are available, as you said. as opposed to like being with their handlers. And Magnus was always like that. Magnus was almost never available. But luckily, since I'm a GM, I was at some of the after stuff. So I saw those guys, you know, loosen up and, you know, and party and such, where there wasn't really access for the typical person. But I have a lot of that experience with hanging out with the top players and seeing the lighter side.
Yeah, you told the story in one of our interviews of showing some of your games to Magnus. I mean, that must have been surreal.
Yeah. That was pretty cool. Yeah, Magnus isn't my biggest fan.
Oh, really?
So I think then we were okay.
What happened?
Well,
I think I know what happened, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think I was very negative about his withdrawing from the Sinkfield Cup.
Right.
And in my opinion, if somehow Magnus is 100% right, which I don't think he's right, but if he's right, I don't see why he withdrew from the tournament.
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to play Hans again. Nobody else did anything. Why isn't he playing? He's basically ruining the tournament by leaving. He's the big attraction. And making people have buys every round and him not being there. And it's just all of a sudden was weird.
Yeah.
So I don't like the way he handled it, even based on the way he felt, which is, I just got cheated.
Right.
And I felt like that a lot online. And then usually the next day, I reconsider. I'm like, yeah, they probably weren't cheating. I'm probably just a crazy old man. So I think I'm a crazy old man more than people are cheating. But when you think somebody's cheating, it's very upsetting. It's hard to not be emotional about it.
But yeah, as we saw.
The negative things I said about Magnus leaving the tournament and the fact that I think Hans didn't cheat in that game, you know, Magnus isn't my biggest fan. So luckily, Magnus never thinks about me, so it doesn't matter.
Right, but you have heard that?
No, but I'm sure of it. I'm sure Magnus knows the way I've said and doesn't like it.
I don't know. When he was on the Lex Fridman podcast and, you know, Lex asked him for his favorite YouTube channels, he just mentioned Agadmater, and he sounded like kind of shockingly checked out of chess YouTube to me. I wouldn't be so sure that he knows what you said.
Yeah. Well, let's hope not.
Okay. And one other thing I wanted to add about like attending these tournaments when I was saying maybe it's not the same, I do really appreciate that places like the Norway Open and the aforementioned American Chess Festival, like I love when they do turn it into a festival when yes, you can attend the tournament, but then there's also a tournament you can play in and there's events like that, that can make it so that even though you might not have like, you know, great access to these chess celebrities and, you know, amazing players, like you also have a wide variety of activities to do.
You know, one of the things I've enjoyed the most in the last few years of me being a chess player is when I go to tournaments and I quote unquote work at the tournament. Like I just went last month to Baltimore for the National Elementary Championship. I was one of the guest GMs along with Zalugi, and we did simuls and Bughouse and Blitz and lectures and, you know, stuff like that. Is you don't realize, you know, how many fans you have. People want selfies. People want autographs. People tell me they love my channel. And I hear that a lot when I go to tournaments, and it makes me feel better about myself that I've actually accomplished something in life that people enjoy. Because, you know, if you're just at home streaming, people are watching your stream and half of them are trash talking.
Right.
And, you know, you don't feel like there's a community that really loves you and enjoys what you're doing. But when I go to live tournaments, I expect, because of how abrasive I am sometimes on my stream and in general, that I'm going to hear some negative feedback. Like, my daughter was watching your channel and all of a sudden you said some of these swear words and my daughter's only 7. That's what I expect. That never happens. And instead they're like, my son and daughter watch your channel. And I'm like, your son's 6. How is he watching my channel and you're not complaining to me? That's what I'm expecting. So people do enjoy watching my content and they tell me so. And that's a real enjoyable part of going to these tournaments is seeing that people actually do like the chess content that I'm putting out.
Yeah. It's weird how so much sort of online hate is stuff that no one would say to you in real life, you know?
Yeah. No, I never get, in fact, somebody once at a tournament said, you banned me on your stream, but they thought it was funny. They weren't complaining. They were just like, that's funny. And I was like, all right. I've banned so many people. I don't know who you are.
You've got a quick trigger finger. Yeah. Someone in Twitter replies was lamenting that you'd been blocked. They'd been blocked by you unjustly in their mind.
It was very just.
Stand by your actions. All right. Mm-hmm. And Ben, so you mentioned your content. You've got a new Chessable course out on 1D4. First of all, why 1D4? Why this?
It's starting out with D4. D4 is a move that I've played almost all of my life. And I wanted to do something I had knowledge about. And I knew that if I did this course, that I would actually learn a lot myself about these opening variations and what I've been doing my whole life. And I worked over 5 months on this course. This is the most chess work I've done on one course in my life. And it's the hardest I've worked. And I wanted it to be accurate where somebody's not going to complain on Chessable, hey, move 7, my engine says this move wins for black, your line is crap. That's not going to happen because I use several engines plus my own judgment. And it took me a long time to make sure the moves were all correct and try to give the most variations from my opponent's side, even if they were bad, to show how to punish it. And I think, you know, for me playing D4 for the last 30 years, I really had a good idea of what I wanted to do in the course and what variations I wanted to show and, you know, just relearn the stuff that I've been doing my whole life.
Yeah, I'm sure you learned a ton. Because as you've mentioned, I mean, you're primarily playing blitz, you know, you're doing all your events and your lectures. So like to go that deep in theory.
I don't want to interrupt you, although I do. When I was making the Chessable course, and I'm still making it, I was always playing my Chessable lines in my stream in blitz games and saying, this is in my Chessable course. This is telling the audience. And then I'm like, okay, that moves down in the Chessable course. Like my opponent would make some move that, in one instance, they made a move that like hung material, which I actually mentioned in my Chessable course. This move hangs material. You can't do that. Then my opponent did that instead of playing the main line. Okay. And, you know, that way I can see how the openings are doing in my blitz games and people can see what I cover in my Chessable course. And I get to use it to help myself also.
And when you take, like when you do a course like this, are you remembering a lot of the moves that you come across? Because obviously, I'm sure you're learning, like even though you know this stuff well for playing it from 30 years, you're learning or coming across many new moves. Do you sort of automatically remember it if you come across one, or does it take work for you to remember it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember stuff that I've done, and then I remember the better lines that I haven't done yet.
Okay.
I'm like, wait, that's not what I do, but that's the best line. So I can tell when I know something and when I don't know it. And when I don't know it and it's the right line, that's the line that I'm giving in my... And there's actually one particular game where I was playing... I'm drawing a blank. Sarkar, Justin Sarkar.
Okay.
I remember his name for a second. That's what happens when you get older, Ben. You'll see. So I was playing Justin Sarkar and it's all the way to the end of my Chessable line. And I said, this is the best move. And then I'm like, unfortunately, against Justin Sarkar, this is like, you know, more than 10 years ago, I played this and I was lucky to draw. But if I had played this, then I have a nice advantage. And so I'm like, yeah, against Sarkar, I remember I didn't know this position at the time. And I played it wrong. And this happened in the game with Akobi, and also where my Chessable course recommends an improvement over the way that I played. I drew that game also. I guess I draw a lot of games. But yeah, it's fun to find improvements in your opening play from games you played 10, 20 years ago. And that's going to make sense because, you know, the engines 20 years ago weren't so good. Yeah. So now everything's better and we can play better and we can study better.
Excellent. Yeah. And the course should be out possibly the same day this pod is out. Definitely coming soon.
Yeah. Now, I think so. June 12th.
Yeah, which is when the pod will be out. So, but let me ask you, Ben. So I want to dig deeper on the 1D4 thing. Like, do you have a philosophical preference for D4 over E4? Or is it sort of just you've played it more?
I think when I was starting to figure out what openings to play, because when I was a little kid, I was playing C4. And then between like the ages of 9 and 14, I just played everything. I played D4, C4, E4, Knight F3, B3. And I still sort of do that, but I'm playing 90% D4 in my slow tournament games. And I just found I understood that the best for me, and I had the best results, that it was easier for me to play. That's a me thing. For other people, it could be they prefer to play E4 and they like that. Like Peter Lako, who I just did a class on, like he plays E4 and he understands that. Boy, does he understand that for both sides. So I think it's just a matter of taste. And I played a lot of different openings growing up, and I gravitated to D4 because that seemed to be what spoke to me.
Okay. But you're not going to say it's just better, you know? It's not.
No.
Okay.
First moves, they're all about the same as far as evaluation. It's ones that you understand and you get good positions with and you enjoy playing. And sometimes I get sick of D4, so I just play something else. I'm like, here's E4, here's B3, just to play something new.
Do you think it helped your development as a kid that you played all those different like first moves?
I think so, because I got to decide what I wanted to play instead of having a coach tell me how to play their repertoire or what they like to play. I figured out for myself what I enjoyed playing. And, you know, obviously I learned chess from my dad. He was a master, and he played all kinds of different openings and wasn't a theoretician. So he didn't tell me play this opening or that opening. He didn't think that was important. So we played a lot of blitz chess together, but there wasn't any opening study.
Okay. And I gather that you agree with his philosophy.
Yeah, I think each individual person should find the opening that speaks to them or the variations they like, and not necessarily, you know, have a coach say, I play the Dutch defense, you should play it too.
Right.
That's not the way I teach chess. I think you should play what you like, what you enjoy playing. And if you don't like it, you can always switch up. That's the great thing about chess. If you play D4 and you start hating it, you can play E4. And a lot of the top players in the world are very flexible in the openings they play. They'll play, you know, two or three different ways in any variation, just depending on their mood.
We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Ben Feingold. And we are back. And we got another opening question for you, Ben, from the Patreon mailbag. This one is from longtime supporter Tyron Ross Price. Thanks for supporting the pod, Tyron. And he mentions that Mark Esserman has a Feingold refutation chapter in Mayhem in the Mora, which is also available on Chessable. Also, speaking of like openings that speak to people who play the Smith Mora love the Smith Mora. So he asks if you have a refutation to the Feingold refutation.
I haven't read Mayhem in the Mora, but I've seen that it exists. And the Feingold defense book was written in the year 2000.
Wow.
So I know it's amazing how long ago it was with co-author with Bob Schifoni. And what's funny is when I play blitz chess against lower rated players on chess.com, I try to play the Mora because I think it's fun. I would never play it in a slow game, but in blitz chess, I'll play the Mora with white. And with black, I'm playing the Feingold defense still. And so far, nothing bad has happened. I get good positions out of the openings. Often, I'm just a pawn up for nothing. And it wasn't really me that discovered this way of playing. Schifoni discovered it and wanted me to co-author a book with him. And he said, I can't call it the Schifoni defense because nobody will buy the book. But I've played it a lot since the book has come out, which is a long time ago. But I haven't done any serious study in the last few years on that variation. So I can't really speak to what Esserman said. But Esserman himself, I think, doesn't even think that the Mora is the best line for white. He just enjoys playing it. And he enjoys his great success because he really understands it. I mean, that's why Esserman's so good at the Mora. That speaks to him. That's the kind of chess he wants to play. And you know, there's probably some lines he doesn't like to face more than others, but he knows more about it than his opponent. And that's what you want in an opening, is you know the opening and your opponent doesn't. And that's definitely what he's getting a lot of the time.
Yeah. And at his level as an IM, obviously, he's strong enough where maybe it's not optimal for his results, although maybe it is. But I know he has sort of like a cult following in the Smith-Moore. And I feel like for everyone below 2000, like it has to be a very good choice if you know it that well and you're excited about it.
No, I agree.
No Sicilian player wants to face it, you know?
No, I think if you can get the initiative early in the game with white or black against players your own rating at the club level, that's going to be really good for you. Most players below 2000 aren't great defenders. That's one of the biggest weaknesses in their game, is defending is not their strong suit. And if you enjoy playing those lines, those are just the right lines for you. And I don't want to force somebody to do it. Some people don't want to be a pawn down. They don't want to play the Smith-Mora. So there's no reason to do that.
And aside from this D4 course, is there an opening that you feel like really speaks to you? Do you have a personal favorite, Ben?
I think my personal favorite throughout my career, with white at least, is the Queen C2 Nimzo Indian. I've been playing since I was 14. And I think the Nimzo Indian is maybe the biggest chapter in my course, because I really dive deep into the Queen C2 Nimzo Indian because I have so many games and so many memories of things that happened that were good. And that's the opening I think I know the best of all openings, just because I've played it for so long and I've had good results throughout the years.
Yeah, it's still topical. I mean, still see it all the time at the top levels. And speaking of the top levels, I don't want to cover Norway chess too much because it seems like we probably know who's going to win. But nonetheless, like, you know, storylines will develop subsequent to between when this records and when this comes out. But it looks like Fabiano's back at number two in the world live rankings, and more likely than not, he will win this tournament. Does that surprise you? Did you think when he fell to number 14 that he would rise again?
I wasn't sure, because that seemed crazy to me that he would not be in the top 10. That's not the Fabi that I know. Even dropping out of the top five is weird for me. So it was surprising when he fell down so fast, but it's not surprising to me that he's playing well again, because he's always capable of just having a great tournament. And a lot of chess isn't classical chess anymore, so a lot of the ratings aren't changing very much. And some people, like Anand, are doing well by not playing. They're staying in the top 10 by not playing in tournaments, which is funny. I'm not surprised that he, you know, came back. And, you know, I was surprised when he fell to 14. That was shocking to me, because I don't think of Fabi as somebody who's not top 10 and probably not even not top five. He's just always top five to me.
Yeah. And obviously he and Christian have been busy pumping out content for the C Squared podcast, but it's good to see that that's not holding back his chess skills. Apparently he's still finding some time to study.
Exactly.
And what about the Magnus of it all? I mean, there's been some talk, you know, I got the aforementioned Alex Fishbein. I have to give him props when I interviewed him last year, and he was vocal about this on Facebook as well. As soon as Magnus retired, he said, you know, he's going to fall off. He's not going to be as strong. And I was skeptical at the time. Obviously, the final story has not been told, but he's not playing at the same level. Does that surprise you, Ben? Or at least not achieving the same results, I should say.
No, I think he's not putting all of his energy into chess. And I think people like Fischer and Kasparov and Magnus put all their energy into chess, and they got to the top. And once you stop putting all your energy in chess and living your life and relaxing and having fun, then your chess is going to suffer. And I don't think that's a negative thing for Magnus. I think he wants to live his life and do what he wants to do. He's already been best player in the world for 10 years or more, so he doesn't see any reason to be the best player in the world for 20 years. He'd rather do other stuff, and he wants to play for fun. So it's not surprising that he's not doing as well as he used to. Having said that, he's still the best player in the world.
Right.
He's just not way the best player in the world. He's, you know, the best player in the world. But yeah, he had a bad blitz tournament in Norway. He came in seventh. He's not doing well in this tournament. In the classical portion, he's minus one. But, you know, if people are working hard and you're not, that's going to show. And Dmitry Gurevich, it's a funny story. On ICC about 20 years ago, Mark Ginsburg was playing Eric Lobra on Blitz Chess, and Mark Ginsburg was winning. And I said to Dmitry Gurevich, Mark Ginsburg can't win against Lobron. That doesn't make any sense. And I told him how good Lobron was. And he and Dmitry said, you don't stay the same in chess. He says, either you get better or you get worse. There's no staying the same.
Yeah.
So if you're like not taking chess seriously, which Lobron hasn't in 20 years, but he might take some drinking seriously, but not doesn't take chess seriously anymore, then he's not going to be the same strength. It's going to get worse. And Magnus can't be 2870 and then play poker half the time and go out partying half the time and be 2870. He's either has to work really hard and try to get his rating up, or he has to have fun in his life and his rating goes down. And I don't begrudge him for that. He's already proven all he has to in chess. Now he's got other stuff he wants to do, and he wants to play chess for fun. And he's not going to do like with five coaches and prepare for 3 weeks for a tournament. That's just not, you know, that's not what he wants to do anymore.
Yeah. He doesn't owe us anything. I it's a good point.
Yeah. He's just living his life.
Yeah. And, but Hikaru meanwhile is kind of like a weird example because obviously not quite at Magnus's level, but why do you think it is that he is managing to maintain his level?
It's funny. I think a lot of it is how relaxed he is. You know, he goes to the tournament and he's like, I'm a streamer. This is for fun. And I think he still studies the openings a lot because his opening play seems better than it used to be. And he still works with Little John. And he doesn't play in a lot of slow tournaments. So when he does play, he's hungry. And I think people who just play, you know, every week, like Jay Bonin used to do, you know, it becomes monotonous at some point. So he's not playing in these tournaments for the money. He's not playing to become world champion. He's playing because he likes to play chess and he wants to play in a tournament every now and then and get some accolades. So I think he's just much more relaxed about his chess than he was, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing to see. I mean, and yeah, he does.
No, it is that he can keep his level with just playing Blitz Chess online, basically.
Yeah, although, and to be fair, playing it a ton and playing the title Tuesdays.
Playing a lot of good players, too, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of these rapid tournaments, everybody's really good.
And Ben, out of these young bucks, I know you've done a video series on a few of them, like Faruja. Is there like who would you peg as if you were to bet on one person to be the next world champion?
Let's see. Out of the top junior players, like 2 years ago, I would have told you Nihal Sarin, and probably now.
I think 2 years ago you did tell me Nihal Sarin.
Did I?
Well, you mentioned him. You mentioned that you thought maybe he was a bigger talent than Prague. Yeah.
I guess of all the top Indian talents, and I'll throw in Abdu Sattarov as somebody else, probably Iragassi is the one with the best chance.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, Arjun.
Yeah.
Yeah, he seems incredibly good. And Magnus, a close second to Gukesh.
Okay. Magnus has
been Iragassi and Gukesh.
Magnus seems to be a fan of Abdusatarov's fighting spirit in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And what about
Abdusatarov is really good. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me either. There's a lot of good junior players now.
Yeah. And what about the older guard? I mean, obviously, people like Caruana and Geary seem to have a high chance of making the candidates. We know Nepo will be there. We don't know much beyond that in terms of who exactly will get to play. But if you were to pick just the next candidates winner, probably focusing on the people we know, who would you favor?
The next candidates winner. I don't know. Probably the safe pick is Fabi.
Yeah.
I think he's the safe pick. If he plays in the candidates, I don't know if he's qualified.
Yeah. But I mean, I think this Norway chess, I think all these formats are so convoluted, mm-hmm. but it counts towards the Grand Prix points, which count towards the candidates. Yeah. So,
we'll probably play the next candidates.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll pick Fabi.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I would love for him to Fabi Ding.
If Fabi plays a match with Ding, Fabi will probably be the favorite.
Yeah. I would think so too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And last topic, Ben. So you mentioned you've got the American Open coming up. Shout out to Karen.
National Open. National. Or,
I always do that. I apologize to the National Open organizers. And shout out to Karen, who recently qualified for the World Series main event, World Series of Poker. Now, I know you've had some interest in poker over the years. We've played together way back in the day. What's going to be your role while Karen's playing poker? What are you going to do?
I'll be playing poker.
Cash games or tournaments or?
Mainly cash games. I might get into one tournament, although the lines are scaring me. But I'll be playing poker when she's playing poker. Probably I'll play 90% or more cash games. And she probably won't play any cash games. She likes tournaments a lot more than I do. And I like cash games a lot more. So.
And what's your typical cash game?
I just play either 1-2 or 1-3.
No limit.
Buy in for 300 or 400, whatever.
Wow, so grounded as a big-time chess streamer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you win?
Well, what's that?
Are you a winning
player? Sometimes I win, sometimes I lose, but... I go on tilt a lot in my own mind, not because I'm doing badly. I have like my own tilt. So I have to be more calm. And as always been the case in my poker career, I play great the first hour, then my play goes downhill. So maybe I should cash out after an hour.
Right. I was going to say that's a good reason to play cash
games.
Yeah,
get some lunch.
And what else? Do you have any other chess events on the docket?
No, we got, and Karen hasn't played chess in a long time because she's been focusing on poker. And about once a month, we go to Cherokee in North Carolina and play poker. And sometimes they have WSOP circuit events and Karen plays in those. So we know more about the poker scene now than the chess scene.
That's funny. And when Karen,
as far as playing in tournaments.
So for listeners who didn't hear it, I did an Adult Improver interview with Ben's wife, Karen Boyd, probably about a year ago, where she did mention she was spending 3 to 4 hours working on chess in addition to competing all the time. The summer had just concluded, so she had played in the World Open and all these events. So Is she like, obviously you have to travel to play poker, but is she channeling that time into actual study? And if so, what does that study even look like these days?
Yeah, her study is dedicated to poker now. So she buys courses and watches videos and joins groups where people are talking about poker. And she has poker coaches that teach classes with a lot of students. And she's studying tables and all kinds of things I don't understand that are mainly for tournaments because she really wants to play well in the tournaments. She likes tournaments more than cash. And I mean, she studies poker probably more than she studied chess, and she was studying chess a lot.
Right.
But she studies poker almost all day.
Amazing. Well, shout out to Karen. We'll definitely be rooting for her.
I mean, that's how you get good at stuff is you work at it.
Yeah.
You don't see somebody else do it and say, I can do that. There's a reason why people make it to the NBA and the NFL and the final table of the World Series because they're working hard.
Yeah. Speaking of the NBA, the other night you were streaming during the finals. So are you somewhat checked out? I know you mentioned James Harden.
No, I watch whenever I can, but I have my streaming schedule.
Okay.
So you'd think they would set the NBA finals around my streaming schedule, but with the commissioner, they're just not doing it.
And when you do something like that, like do you have a TV in the room? Are you ever checking out like a sporting event?
No, I just do my stream. And then when my stream's done, I'll watch the rest of the game.
Okay.
Same with the Braves. I watch the Braves games, but when I'm streaming.
Okay.
And then I'll check the score on my phone. I'll see what the score is, but I'm not watching the game actively.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Ben, it has been a pleasure as always. Anything to add about the Chessable course in particular, or like, are you going to do another Chessable course, do you think, or we'll see how this one goes
eventually
first?
Yeah. And also I have a master class that's related to the course that's going to happen at the end of July. And that's going to be on sale with the course. You can buy it as a bundle if you'd like.
Excellent. But Ben, thanks for your patience during our attempt to stream it. And always a pleasure to...
Yeah, that was my fault. Sorry, Ben.
No, that was...
It's all about us.
All right. Thanks as always, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me again.
Podcast Network.